It's the Burt Cohen Show.
Hang in there. Thanks. I'll put you on hold for just a minute.
And it seems like the dream just has to include wars. You know, it's amazing. As the XTC sang, generals and majors seem so unhappy unless they got a war. But the generals and majors, when it comes to the new Iraq War, Iraq War 3.0, they're actually not real happy about it. And we'll be talking about that. What is this 3.0 war? Is it possible? What could possibly go right is the question our guest asked today about the latest in a long series of wars in Iraq. It's been said that despite the way it's being reported in the U.S., the new war in the Middle East looks to most of the world like another case of American unilateralism, which plays right into the radical Islamic narrative. Now, we don't want ISIS to win, but what can we do? It seems like the more we bomb them, the more territory ISIS takes. We can't do nothing. They're not good guys. Lord knows. Well, our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show, Peter Van Buren. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Burt, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Peter Van Buren is a 24-year veteran of the State Department who spent a year in Iraq. Following his book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, the Department of State began proceedings against him. That speaks well of him, though through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, two very good groups, Van Buren instead retired from the State Department or in his own terms. Peter's commentary has been featured in such prestigious places as the New York Times, Reuters, Salon, NPR, Al Jazeera, The Huffington Post, The Nation, Tom Dispatch, American Conservative Magazine, and a whole bunch of others. He's appeared on BBC World Service, NPR's All Things Considered, Fresh Air, HuffPo Live, Britain's Channel 4 Viewpoint, Dutch Television, and more. Van Buren's new book is about the social and economic changes in America between World War II and the decline of the blue-collar middle class in the 1980s. Thank you, Ronald Reagan, I'm sure. His new book is called Ghosts of Tom Joad, A Story of the 99%, and it's available now. The article originally appeared in Tom Dispatch, the one we're going to talk about today, called America's George W. Bush Disorder, Why Our New Iraq War is Doomed to Fail. 4 months into our latest humanitarian mission, it's fair to ask, what could possibly go right? So on this Burt Cohen Show, we'll look at examples of why Van Buren says American strategy cannot go right. Well, again, Peter Van Buren, thanks for being with us. As you say, the goal of the first bombing runs by American forces was to save the Yazidis. Now, of course, Americans had never heard of the Yazidis before, but we did save a lot of lives. Did we not need to do that? Maybe you can talk about what that was a little bit first off.
There's many conflicting issues with Iraq War III and the line between imperialism, conquest, unclear fighting, and humanitarian issues can sometimes get blurry. Nothing I'm going to say is in favor of people being killed or humanitarian actions when they're necessary not happening. But you need to pull back and ask the questions of, was in fact what the United States did early on a humanitarian action? Did it actually save anyone? And if humanitarian action was necessary, did we do it in the way that was really the best for the people on the ground? So let's start with that last one, because I think that's very, very important. Yazidi people were isolated on a mountaintop, such as we understand it, and had been there for some period of time. We found out later that many of them had gone there voluntarily. It has religious and cultural significance to them. And they were apparently not as hungry or as in need of water and supplies as we were originally told. The United States apparently did very, very little research into all this and was looking, I believe, for a reason to get back involved in Iraq, and the Yazidis happened to appear. The humanitarian needs could have easily been satisfied by food drops, by bringing in supplies. And if that truly was what was supposed to happen, one has to ask the question about why only U.S. military power could satisfy that humanitarian cause. Where was the UN? Where was the Red Crescent? Where were the Iraqis? You're left with the conclusion that while there may have been elements of humanitarian action in this, what it really was the bus that the Obama administration decided we were going to get on in order to reinsert us into the Iraqi conflict, and the escalation that quickly happened after that so-called humanitarian intervention, I think, supports my position.
We are talking with former State Department whistleblower, I suppose. That's not a bad word to use. Peter Van Buren, about Iraq War III. What could possibly go right in what we're doing? Very interesting discussion about the Yazidis and shedding a little light on it. It's amazing how little news we really get here and how it seems to be so often just, you know, I wonder how lazy the reporters are. They just, you know, take what's handed out to them by the government media, the spin that they want to put on it. I don't know. But
well, let's explore that, if I may, Bert.
Yeah, sure, please.
For a second. You know, back in August, when the Yazidis emerged as the most prescient issue in front of the American government, CNN was being flown into onto that mountain in Sinjar where the Yazidi people were.
Uh-huh.
The reporters on those aircraft from CNN were claiming that the flights were destined to save lives, that each one of these flights was going to pull children out who otherwise would have been left to die on the mountain. And, of course, that left begging the question of, if every one of those seats on every one of those flights was a child's life, why was CNN taking up several of them for reporters and camera crews? In addition, it begs the question of exactly how did Iraqi military flights suddenly become available to CNN reporters who happened to be, I guess, in the area. It raises many questions about the role of the media being manipulated, or I guess I should say better, presenting themselves for manipulation.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You see the same thing. The media tends to be present for events in Iraq. The Western media tends to be present for events in Iraq that are labeled as victories, and they tend to be very absent from events that seem to not be victories for, quote-unquote, our side.
Hmm. And, you know, how different things are. Back in 1971, I believe it was, we had a very independent and courageous media reporting the Pentagon Papers, which the government really did not want to be released, but they did it anyway. My goodness, how things have changed since then. And referring to the start of Iraq War 3.0, you write, Peter, think of what transpired as several years of early Vietnam-era escalation compressed into a semester. Please explain what you mean by that.
Parallels between what's going on in Iraq now and what happened during the Vietnam War are very hard to ignore. And it's important for people, particularly young people who don't have personal memories of the Vietnam era, to take a look back at some of that history. In the early days of the war, the United States was maintaining a semi-covert presence, and the American soldiers that were in Vietnam at that time were called advisors and trainers, and were very clearly labeled not as fighters or combat troops. I guess the term now is boots on the ground. And they were not there to fight. They were there just to help the Vietnamese do their own fighting. We then had an incident, the Gulf of Tonkin incident,
yes,
where the American people were told that the North Vietnamese had attacked our ships and we had no choice but to fight back. It's hard to separate something like that, which history now tells us was fabricated.
Totally.
Didn't happen.
Right.
With what happened with the Yazidis, and we suddenly slid down a slope in Vietnam that over a period of about 2 years brought American combat forces into a war that we know ended very badly for everyone.
Yeah.
Here in Iraq 3.0, we've managed to take that cycle and compress it now into a couple of months. We started with the so-called cause belli, the Yazidi people, who, by the way, are still not doing very well. They're still being under attack from ISIS. They just aren't being helped anymore. We started with a cause that everyone felt they should get behind, a humanitarian action. We segued very quickly from that to having to defend the Americans that were in Iraq. The first airstrikes and first trainers were sent in to protect the Americans, apparently those at the embassy and other military facilities who America had sent over there. But nonetheless, the next phase, of course, was the Kurds. This was presented as another almost humanitarian gesture. And at that point, the gloves came off and we very quickly doubled and then now have doubled again the number of American, quote, advisors and trainers. We've begun shipping arms and weapons into Iraq. American helicopters are in combat. And quite famously, we are conducting a 24/7 daily bombing campaign all across Iraq, spreading into Syria, using some of America's heaviest armaments and weapons against what appears to be largely an insurgent group. Anyone who takes a look at the early history of the Vietnam War can draw the parallels, and I encourage your listeners who didn't experience all that to go back and read a little history.
Yes, reading a little history. We always encourage that on the Bert Cohen Show. It really, really, really is useful. It's so important to look at history, how we got here, and a way to look at that. And it does always seem, I can't think of any war that didn't have an incident that started it. I mean, it goes back to the first thing that comes to my mind is Fort Sumter back in the war between the states, the war against secession. That was, frankly, set up by President Lincoln to provide an excuse to start the war. And then again, you mentioned in Vietnam, there was the whole Tonkin Gulf alleged incident. So the Yazidis, thanks much. You provided an excuse for us to get into a bigger and better war. Oh, my goodness. And
the Yazidis were just like buses. You know, if we had missed that one, there would be another one coming along headed in the same direction.
And, you know, obviously, the U.S. is falling into being the best possible recruiter for ISIS. It seems to me the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, whatever it's called, we know who they are. But, you know, if the picture is one of U.S. versus Muslim fighters, it seems to me that perfectly feeds the ISIS agenda. Now, the White House has been careful pointing out a list of 60 participants in the Coalition of Nations, because we don't want to be seen as the U.S. versus the Muslim patriots. Is there evidence that America's crucial Arab allies are in this fight as well? Tell us about what this Coalition of Nations is in the fight against ISIS.
The U.S. State Department claims that there are 60 countries and organizations around the world who are members of this coalition. And let's just do a quick quiz here, Bert. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Uh-oh.
I'm going to name a country, and then you tell me if it is or is not in the coalition,
okay,
according to the State Department list. Let's start with an easy one, the U.K.
Yes, they're in it.
Okay, of course. Somalia.
No.
They're in it.
Taiwan. Taiwan. Oh, my goodness. Well, since how crazy it is, they must be in it.
Yes, as is Japan and Finland and a whole bunch of other countries.
Iceland, right?
Iceland, I think, is a proud member. Now, you're not allowed to use the term, it's spelled out by the letters BS, I think, on the radio.
Probably not.
But the question remains of how much of this coalition exists in the realms of reality and what it does and how much doesn't. I think one of the scariest issues, however, is the highly limited, very limited Arab participation in this.
Yes.
And it cuts both ways. I mean, the Obama administration plays out the limited Arab participation as a very good thing.
Oh.
We're not alone in this. This is not the West versus Islam and those type of statements that we've heard. I'd like to suggest that it raises an issue, and that is the one of a wider conflict that is metastasizing throughout the Middle East. Borders are very fluid in the Middle East. Many of them are artificial. They
yes.
were created after World War I
yes.
and don't really represent the ground reality, particularly where the divisions exist between those who follow the Sunni side of Islam and those who follow the Shia side. All of the countries that are participating in the bombing have their own agendas. The Arab countries, in particular, have their own agendas, which may or may not match what the United States believes their agendas are and may not match what America's goals are. This is very, very dangerous when you bring these many groups into a fight in the theory that the United States can manage them.
Yeah.
A bomb falling off a Saudi plane is the equivalent of a bomb falling off a Canadian plane. It's not. And in the Middle East, it's not seen that way. And this becomes really a matter of playing with fire.
Mm, yes, we are. And getting it organized. Yeah, right. Knowing who is the bombing, who is doing the bombing. And another thing that the U.S. government has gone great pains to point out is just how many, specifically ISIS fighters, its airstrikes have killed there. We are told, at least according to your article, it was exactly 464, not about 450 or 500, exactly 464. And of course, that brings back to my mind watching TV in the mid-60s and seeing the body counts during the Vietnam War. And it seemed everybody that was killed back then, every single body was counted as a communist fighter, a Viet Cong or a North Vietnamese army member. What about this very specific body count? What do you make about that?
Well, the number is already, I'll hasten to add, about a week old and came specifically out of the airstrikes directed at the small town of Kobane. But,
yes.
but the point it holds. First, obviously, is the question of how the heck does anybody know it's 464? In many cases, bodies that are created by bombing, it's pretty hard to even find all the parts. Next, I mean, who's there doing the counting and all these other questions? That automatically makes it all very, very, very suspect. The other is as you pointed out, every time the United States seems to kill someone, it seems to be particularly justified. If we blow up a wedding party in Yemen with one of our drones, well, it was an al-Qaeda wedding party.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to fit. The other issue is, again, the one you just touched on, which is this type of war, body counts are not the way you measure success. And that was something that plagued us throughout Vietnam.
Yes.
Oh, we killed this many Vietnamese, we killed that many Vietnamese. This is not a war of attrition, where if we capture enough of their pieces, we win the chess game. It doesn't work that way. ISIS in particular has proven to be extremely effective at A, using the people that they have, and B, recruiting more of them. And so simply saying we killed this many or this many or this many, it may be true, but it's also irrelevant.
Mm. Like, you know, there's baseball, there's football. However many points you get, that's how you decide who wins. Isn't that the way war works and politics works? Maybe not. Maybe not. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show today with Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran of the State Department, who wrote a book called We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. We're talking about this latest version, Iraq War 3.0. And I have to tell you, on Veterans Day, 2014, my guest was an Iraq War II veteran who told us about the so-called science of counterinsurgency that the military uses, the science of counterinsurgency. What it basically means, the way he described it, was that with enough occupation troops in control for long enough, you know, a certain ratio of people that are being controlled compared to occupation troops, and they do it for long enough, of course, that's measurable, quantifiable, any insurgency can be defeated. Now, this seems to fit perfectly with what you write. Quote, if at first we don't succeed, do the same thing harder with better technology and at greater expense. I wonder if you could talk about that, please.
The most obvious rebuttal to a statement as silly as that is to ask, why hasn't it worked? And it's very difficult to point to any American counterinsurgency strategy in any country. And we've been doing this really continuously since roughly the end of World War II.
Yes.
That where it's worked. It didn't work as we go back to Vietnam. It didn't work in parts of Central America where we did it. It just doesn't seem to work, and it certainly did not work in Iraq 2.0,
right,
which was the most immediate example we can use, and certainly not working in Afghanistan. The concept of that an insurgency is simply an extension of some kind of warfare that needs to be sort of fought the way, you know, you'd fight the Germans back to Berlin, betrays the concept, the idea that an insurgency at its heart, as is ISIS at its heart, is a concept, is an idea. It manifests itself in violence. It manifests itself in terrible things like beheadings. It manifests itself in the capture of cities. But at the end of the day, it's a concept. It's an idea that must be defeated somehow. And you can't blow up ideas very successfully, though the United States continues to try.
Hmm.
You have to fight ideas with other ideas. And when the narrative that the ISIS side, their idea, if you will, that America is an imperial power that is at war with Islam, seems to be strongly supported by the fact that America behaves like an imperial power at war with Islam, means that our idea is not winning. And no matter how many soldiers you put on the ground and how many counterinsurgency manuals they read, until you fix the underlying war of ideas, if you'll pardon the almost the pun, you're going to lose.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking about the appeal of ISIS. I mean, when we in the West look at what ISIS is, it's horrifying. It's just not exactly appealing, shall we say. It seems to me, and tell me what you know about this, Peter Van Buren, that the spark that lit the ISIS fire was, frankly, the new Iraqi government, the one that the United States put in place by toppling Saddam Hussein. Clearly, it was not fair to all concerned. But wait a minute, there's a new, more inclusive Iraqi government in place now. This must help matters now. I mean, you talk about, you know, contrasting ideas. Okay, there was a lot of anger that a large group of Iraqis was left out by the old Iraqi occupation government that we put in there. Isn't the new government better?
America seems to think that installing these puppet governments, if you will, it's like picking a sports team. You know, it's like, oh, the old pitcher hasn't won a game in a while, so let's go out and get a new one. Maybe he'll do better.
Boy, we did that a lot in Vietnam.
And, boy, we keep circling back to that, don't we? If I had a chance, I'd bring a good history of the war to the president and suggest he take a day or two off and read through it, because I suspect he has not done that recently. But the government that the United States put in place in Iraq, the Maliki government,
right,
that we midwifed in 2006 and supported with as much money and American lives as we could get away with all the way through this summer, was quite anti-Sunni. In fact, anti-Sunni to the point where it allowed Shia militias to act as death squads, where it used the organs of government, particularly the Ministry of the Interior and with the police and the courts, to persecute, prosecute, and murder Sunnis. Don't forget that Maliki's first official act after leaving a celebratory tour of the White House with Obama was to first fire his Sunni vice president, and then, after the vice president went into hiding, have a death sentence imposed on him. Symbolism matters, and people paid attention to that. The Maliki government continued those actions right up until the end of this summer, when the United States decided it was time to put in a relief pitcher and assisted the current prime minister, Abadi, to take over. Now, the word inclusive and unity government is bandied around. In fact, President Obama himself ordered a doubling of troops, claimed that this was a new phase now that Iraq has achieved a unity government. The problem is that Prime Minister Abadi comes from the same sect of the same political party that Maliki did, Shia part of the government. And in fact, Maliki still is in government as a vice president. So the players haven't changed significantly. What is significant is the opportunity for a very clear gesture of unity that Abadi had was squandered. He appointed not only a Shia as Minister of Interior, but a Shia directly allied with the Badr militia. Most Americans probably don't recognize that name, but every Sunni in Iraq does. The Badr militias were the leading death squads. They were the people who were conducting beheadings of Sunnis long before Americans focused on that particularly horrible way to die.
Yes.
The Badr militia now controls the Ministry of Interior, and Abadi has encouraged the Shia militias, including the Badr, to go out and fight ISIS, mainly because the Iraqi army ran away at first blood.
Mm-hmm.
So this new government looks an awful lot like the old government, acts an awful lot like the old government, and continues to treat Sunnis very much as the old government did. So like the song says, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. And if Obama truly believes he's got something new to work with in Iraq, then he is beyond delusional.
Whoa, does that bring me back, you know, during the Vietnam War, and I recognize there are a few people out there who don't remember the Vietnam War or were born way after that. It was amazing. There was one government after another after another. We'd keep changing the pitchers, as it were, you know, bring in the relief pitcher. And you know what? The people of Vietnam, they didn't want the new relief pitchers. They wanted their own government. Imagine that. I can't help but think that that is one of the draws of ISIS. And I want to get to that, but before we do, you know, let's face it, Americans, we're over here, Sunni, Shia, what the heck? We don't largely know the difference. The Shia have been in charge of Iraq for quite some time. What kind of population are Sunni? Are they a large percentage of the people who live within the current border of Iraq?
They're a very small minority compared to the Shias within Iraq. I can't pull a number right off the top of my head.
Sure,
I said 10 to 20%, I don't think I'd be too far off.
But
Sunnis were in charge, however. Saddam Hussein was a Sunni and his Ba'athist party that, by the way, was helped into power in the 1960s by the CIA.
Mm.
And Saddam, of course, was our good buddy during the 1980s when he was fighting the Iranians as kind of a proxy. But anyway, well, that's all that naughty history stuff. The Ba'athists were in charge, and they were very unkind to the Sunni to the Shia majority, and they maintained their power through aggressive use of the military, through a vicious secret police, through manipulation of the courts and the other organs of government. When the United States toppled Saddam Hussein, being a Sunni was not a very good thing to do. And as a counter to what the United States was afraid was going to happen, a Sunni resurgence, the Shias were allowed to take control. And the United States continues to support the Shias today, albeit kind of in a convoluted, not well thought out way. But that's what we are doing. For the Shias, it's payback time. And it has been for several years, and there's no sign that they intend to stop it. One thing listeners may wish to do to kind of track all this is to keep an eye on who is doing the fighting for the so-called Iraqi government. And the more Shia militias you see and the fewer Iraqi army units you see, the worse things are. And exactly how they are achieving some of these victories we keep hearing about in Western Iraq. One more time with Vietnam, there was a very famous phrase that came out of that war. We have to destroy that village in order to save it.
Yes.
And the United States famously bombed a town called Ben Tre into the dust to keep it out of North Vietnamese hands. Many of the Shia victories over ISIS, and every word in that sentence is in air quotes, have involved the destruction of Sunni towns, some of them razed right down to the foundations, artillery, air fire, air power, and ground fire being used to basically decimate the village, the town. And at that point, clearly there is no ISIS there, and there are no Sunnis there, and there is no village there. But in the Western media calculus, well, ISIS has been pushed back from another small town or another village. When you see victories like that, you want to be a very skeptical consumer of media, and you want to ask yourself who is, in fact, winning those struggles.
Right.
Kobane is a perfect example.
Yeah, I was just going to ask.
200,000 refugees out of that city. If we win, what have we won?
Right. So the town of Kobane is right on the border with Turkey, and you say it will be a faux victory, if it's a victory at all, to accomplish nothing of substance. So, you know, a lot of eyes have been focused on this town of Kobane. Can we, the anti-ISIS forces, win it? I wonder if, you know, I don't know who lives there or if they, which side most of them are on. Supposing we do win, all in quotes, as you say, the fight for Kobane, then what? What's accomplished there?
Kobane is a very small town, city, I'm not sure what you'd like to call it, on the Syrian-Turkish border that, like the Yazidi people, no one had ever heard of before.
Oh, for sure.
ISIS had moved into it largely, I think, as a challenge see what the Turks would do.
Yes.
And the Turks, of course, got their own game going. They're terrified of Kurdish independence. They would very much like to see ISIS fighting Assad. They'd like to contain ISIS within Syria. That's a separate discussion. The fight was on. The United States pushed the Turks into intervening. The Turks stood their ground and said, no way. The United States at one point actually wrote Kobane off. There were many statements, including by John Kerry, the Secretary of State, who said, you know, we've got a broad strategy here, and not every fight is important to that broad strategy, and basically seemed to say that Kobane was not really anything America was going to fuss with. When a lot of the president's right-wing critics kind of jumped on all this, suddenly Kobane moved from a sideshow into a focal point of America's efforts, and a lot of air power was aimed at it. The United States facilitated the movement of Kurdish fighters out of their own territories into Kobane, negotiated with the Turks to allow some of those fighters to cross the Turkish border, and may or may not have brought some either special forces or paramilitaries into Kobane to help. We can only point out that American air power suddenly got an awful lot more precise at one point. You know, maybe they got guys with better glasses. I don't know, but that often suggests people on the ground spotting who are American trained or Americans, of course, spotting for the air power. But none of that matters. What matters is Kobane. It doesn't matter in and of itself. It's become symbolic, and the United States is now trying to define that symbolism as a potential victory. To others, the symbolism may be that the Turks, a NATO ally, are choosing not to get involved. It may be symbolic that ISIS can gather troops and assault a target more as an army than as an insurgency. And it may be symbolic maybe of this whole war, that by shredding this town, creating 200,000 refugees, basically at some point reducing it to dust. We have once again won a victory, saved a village by destroying it.
Boy, can I think of examples of history in the First World War, the Great War, Passchendaele, when, I think about 250,000, 300,000 young men died over 5 miles of earth, and it didn't matter. It didn't matter. It simply didn't matter. We are talking with Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran of the State Department who spent a year in Iraq and has written about it. His book, first book is We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. His new book is Ghosts of Tom Joad, A Story of the 99%, and that is available now. We're talking about Iraq War 3.0. The question is, what could possibly go right? It's pretty amazing. Now, we talked a little bit about Turkey. They're another key player. There's Erdogan, the president or prime minister, I'm not sure which, leader of Turkey, I understand would rather have ISIS on his border than an independent Kurdistan. Now, how big of a role is Turkey playing in this? And with regard to the Kurds, and the Kurds reportedly are some of the best fighters against ISIS. So Turkey, you know, has been a relatively moderate country. They can't be even quietly supporting ISIS, or can they?
You know, this speaks to the complicated nature of life in the Middle East.
Yes.
The joke about, you know, we're playing checkers, they're playing chess, may apply. Yeah. It's more like three-dimensional Star Trek chess, I think, than anything else. You know, the Turks are a very interesting group of folks, and throughout Turkish history, they have historically sat at the intersection of East and West, if you will, between Europe and the Middle East, and their interests lie on both sides. In this case, the Turks are primarily concerned about the Kurds. Turkey has a small, well, relatively large, maybe off 20% of their population, all clumped up in the eastern part of the country, where they represent in that part of the world, that part of the country, a much bigger chunk of things. A strong Kurdish minority who has fought a bitter struggle against the Turkish government for their own independence. Until the European diplomacy actually stopped the fighting, some 40,000 people were killed in that insurgency, something that doesn't get a lot of attention in the West. And the rise of a Kurdish nation within Iraq, which is something that the United States is now supporting, because the Kurds appear to be the only force that can put together an army at this time, at least one that can be successful against ISIS without slaughtering Sunnis in their spare time. There's a large Kurdish force now sitting on Turkey's border. They are terrified that their minority will bond with that force in some way and rise up and take over there. And so that's why the Turks are not as happy about America's efforts as America might like them to be. At the same time, the Turks are also concerned about Assad, the president of Syria,
yes,
and have no interest in seeing his side of the equation strengthened. ISIS doesn't like Assad either, and so you get that strange bedfellows kind of thing where people make alliances for their own self-interest and needs, and those alliances often conflict directly with America's geopolitical fantasies and wishes. Just because America wants a coalition to exist doesn't mean that that's enough to create a coalition.
No, but it paints such a pretty picture, you know.
It does.
Oh, my goodness. Well, another country, of course, that's involved in this, and I use the term country. I mean, these lines were drawn, as you mentioned, I believe 1919. And one of the things that ISIS fighters really care about is the, I believe it's the Sykes-Picot line, which they have desperately wanted to destroy, that was created by bureaucrats in England, I believe, in 1919. But it has nothing to do with reality on the ground. Syria, you know, they're here too. And Obama in September said that the U.S. was going to arm so-called moderate rebels in the Syrian civil war. Now, moderate rebels, sending them all kinds of weapons, is that a good idea? I mean, is there such a thing as moderate rebels? Are they predictable? Are they going to be on our side?
People talk about moderate rebels in Syria the way people talk about unicorns, something you've often heard about, and there's quite a legend, but in fact, no one's ever seen one of them. I don't even know how you define a moderate rebel. I'm not even sure how the president is defining a moderate rebel. It seems to be, you know, a group of folks who, you know, because they're all Islamic fighters who, you know, who are not, you know, too Islamic and who seem to be, you know, not really friends with Assad, but not really ready to fight him too much just right now. And they're probably Sunnis anyway, because that's who lives in that part of the world. But they're willing to fight ISIS. You know, it's pretty hard to actually pin these folks down. I mean, if I was ever allowed in the White House to ask a question at one of these briefings, it would be, please define moderate rebel specifically and see how they try to answer that. You know, who the United States is going to arm, if we're going to arm anyone, and what we expect them to do, are silly questions. I mean, I lack the words to describe how ridiculous those statements really are. But let's pick a few just for fun here. First, of course, is who these people are and where they exist. The answer is it's pretty hard to figure out. Right. Second, how do you actually vet them? How do you come to the conclusion that one guy with an AK-47 is somehow on your side more than the other guy with an AK-47? And then there's the question of weapons. As we saw in the great failed adventure to liberate Libya, where he disposed of Muammar Gaddafi and failed to create anything to follow on and essentially turned a country that was relatively stable into another chaotic mess.
Yes.
Weapons proliferate. They move. You cannot control what happens to them once you release them into the wild. If Libya is too historical of an example, I mean, that came from, 2012, take a look at right now. Most of the heavy weaponry that ISIS is fighting with was left on the battlefield by the Iraqi army. Iraqi army, of course, got it from the United States. So when you start pouring weapons into these conflict zones, you have to assume they're going to migrate, they're going to go other places, and they're going to create situations like you have right now in Iraq, where American weapons are being used against America's allies and are being destroyed by Americans' own air power. The only people who do well in that, I guess, are the defense contractors. They're selling stuff on both sides.
Well, they always seem to do well, and it's hard to imagine. I really, truly can't believe, as cynical as I get, that the weapons contractors, the war profiteers, as FDR called them, that we could be fighting this crazy new war because of their need for profits. That's too far out for me. There's got to be some lesser reason than that. But getting back to the countries on the ground, we got Syria, we got Iraq, there's Iran. They're a strong Shia country. Shouldn't they have a place at the table? Does the U.S. refusal to work with the government of Iran unnecessarily exacerbate the problems? Could Iran not be helpful here?
One of the great ironies of all this is that Iran is deeply involved, ostensibly on the same side as the United States. When I was in Iraq, the Iranians were there in great numbers. They were covert forces, but they were the deadly enemy. They were the ones everyone was really afraid of. The Iranians were passing on material and technology to pretty much everybody that was opposing America that created these types of weapons, types of IEDs, that could penetrate the armor that our vehicles use, that could kill us, and they were very deadly. The commander of the Iranian covert forces, General Suleiman, was one of the, if not the top targets of American intelligence. We looked for him for years and never were able to find him and kill him, despite the enormous efforts that were devoted to that. Fast forward, 3 years, 2 years, and all of a sudden, the Iranians are in the field once again in Iraq, but this time the United States is essentially acting as their air force. And who's in control of the Iranian forces? It's General Suleiman again, the same guy. To believe that the Iranians are there in support of the same goals that America is again, delusional. The Iranians are extremely interested in balance of power in the Middle East.
Oh, I bet.
And are especially interested in finding the right balance of Sunni-Shia interests in Iraq, the goal of which is to make sure Iraq is never strong enough to threaten them again. Mm. They fought a bitter war during the 1980s, and the casualties on both sides were horrendous. Yeah. That was when Saddam Hussein famously used chemical weapons against the Iranians. The Iranians and Iraqis traded Scud missiles into each other's large cities. It was a horrible, horrible, bloody war, and the Iranians aren't forgetting that. And don't want a powerful Iraq. And so they're going to intervene, and they're going to play every side of the equation that there is to make sure Iraq does not stay strong. They will also make sure that they retain their influence with the Shia government. Maliki famously took refuge in Iran during the Saddam years, and Abadi has traveled to Tehran on more than one occasion. He will not make a significant move without Iranian support, for many reasons, including the one that probably is foremost in his mind. The Iranians never left Iraq. The Americans withdrew, but the Iranians stayed, and nobody with a brain is going to miss that that signal as well. So the Iranians have their own game. The Iranians are also aware that the United States continues to empower other Sunni nations in the Gulf, the Saudis, the Qataris, the United Arab Emirates, who are all Iran's enemies. And so they need to get involved to make sure that they counter any growing influence of those countries, which is against their national interest.
And
they may or may not also be clever enough to play off America's needs for them to fight ISIS and make some headway on nuclear negotiations and some other issues.
Yeah,
Iran. Complicated.
Iran does have some. It is complicated. Iran does have some interest in working with the United States. You mentioned the very, very wealthy, unimaginably wealthy countries of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others. They are largely out of the obvious picture. But what is their interest in this? It seems to me they're, from what I hear, those royal families are always keeping down the population and buying them off wherever possible, which they can do because they have so much money. But they have some concerns in this regional conflict as well, do they not?
It's harder to kind of parse these things out, particularly because the United States has been very wary of telling us exactly what role these countries are playing.
Yeah, we don't know.
We don't know, and reporters, I actually just spoke with a reporter who was trying to research exactly how many of these airstrikes were conducted by Arab nations, and he was just absolutely getting stonewalled by the Pentagon, and he was just wondering why that was. And, I don't know the answer exactly myself. You know, everybody has a lot of interests on the table. The Sunni countries of the Gulf want to counterbalance Iran's influence. They want to counterbalance the Shia government of Iraq's influence. They want to keep on good terms with the United States. They want to have permission to introduce their weapons into these places as they see fit, without any pushback from each other, from Iraq, or especially from the United States. We're not even going to get involved with the question of how Israel fits into this, how these countries' counters to Israel are a part of it, because we don't have enough hours in the day to parse that all through. The bottom line is the one that we've touched on so many times, Bert, and that is every one of these sides of this story has two more sides, one layer down.
Wow.
The United States insists on painting it all in simplistic terms. The evil ISIS versus the good West. Look, they behead our people. They used the same lines a couple of years ago with Al-Qaeda, and Americans bought them. I'm doing a project right now, actually, we talk about history, looking at anti-Japanese propaganda during World War II. And the similarities are nearly terrifying, including the emphasis on beheadings. The Japanese did behead some Western prisoners.
Yes.
It's unclear exactly how many. But the images of the Japanese soldier raising his samurai sword over the head of a bound prisoner circulated throughout the Western media during World War II. And the same terms are used, the fanatics, the they're willing to die for their religious causes. Substitute the emperor for Allah, and you could use this stuff today.
Oh, yeah. And it
isn't new.
It happened in the First World War when there were stories about German soldiers nailing babies to the doors of churches. I mean, it was just, you know, clearly trying to enrage people. There's the Pentagon, which obviously has to wage the wars by the policymakers. I understand the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, he's not totally in line with our commander-in-chief. I wonder what you know about the Pentagon's attitude toward this new war.
There's a very funny military blog, satirical military blog called The Duffel Bag. If listeners are familiar with the Onion, this is basically a military version of that.
Cool.
And their story today is that Obama changed his relationship status with the military from going steady to complicated on the Facebook page. Martin Dempsey has signaled very clearly that he does not believe that Obama's policy of no combat troops and no boots on the ground is going to work. Right. He has said on more than one occasion that he's used all the code words. He's open to the idea. He may find it necessary to suggest to the president combat troops. You know, he can't come out and say, let's send them in, or Obama's a jerk.
Right.
That's not how the game is played in Washington.
No, can't quite
but
say
he
that.
Has essentially communicated those same ideas. Others in the Pentagon, particularly Secretary of Defense Hagel, have made the same kind of coded statements, basically saying, we're either going to win by sending in combat troops, or we're going to lose by trying to do this too light, too cheap, without getting our hands dirty.
Right.
The Pentagon is really then putting Obama up against the wall and saying, either you do what we want, which is to dramatically escalate this fight, or we're not going to take the blame when this
right.
doesn't work.
Right.
And a lot of that comes out of, we're back there again, Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where the military came out of that war being blamed for the loss and fought back, if you will, in Washington by claiming they were hamstrung by the politicians. They're employing that same strategy once again, and they're not going to be left holding the bag, and they are going to be pushing for more escalation.
Yeah, there's a little bit of CYA going on here,
absolutely.
Folks.
Absolutely.
In the final couple of minutes, what can we do? Look, in Vietnam, we lost the war. Nobody wants to admit that, but we did lose the war. The people of Vietnam won. And it wasn't a bloodbath. It wasn't so bad. In fact, they seem to be pretty good capitalists over there after all. But we can't afford to do that with ISIS now, can we? I mean, what would you do if you were in charge of policy, Peter Van Buren? What can we do about this? We can't let them win.
It's tough because, I mean, there's an easy way and a hard way to answer the question. The easy way is to pretend we're back a year ago. And to talk about how the United States might have helped manage the inevitable partition of Iraq into a
right.
Sunni enclave, a Shia enclave, and a Kurdish enclave.
Right. And Vice President Biden did talk about that a long time ago. Go ahead.
He has. And he was right the first time.
Yes.
And whether the United States wants to do it or not, it's going to happen.
Absolutely.
It's just a matter of how long it takes and how bloody the process is.
Ugh,
we could have used limited military efforts and a lot of economic and diplomatic efforts to manage that process, bring it to as peaceful, as stable a conclusion as possible. And there really wouldn't be much for ISIS to do in Iraq if that had happened.
But that's
what I would have done a year ago. Now, if you ask me what I would do today, given the mess that we've created, boy, that's a tough one. Mm. I don't know how to get the toothpaste back in the tube. I can say that escalating the fight will not make it any better. Pouring more gasoline on the fire never makes the fire go out. And that's what I'm afraid the Obama administration is headed into doing.
Oh, my goodness. Well, on that happy note, his new book is called The Ghosts of Tom Joad, A Story of the 99%. It's available now. Peter Van Buren writes for a whole bunch of different media, Tom Dispatch, Salon, Reuters, etc. Former State Department veteran of 24 years. Very informative and not a little uplifting, quite frankly, but here we are, and it's good to be informed. Thank you very much, Peter Van Buren, for being with us.
Always
today.
A pleasure, Berta. Happy to come back anytime.
We'll do it. I guess we're living with war, folks.
Streets, in the big hotels, in the mosques and the doors.